Okay, let me begin my very brief 9-point summary of a paper on the relationship between critical theory and urban studies with a couple of stories. The first is a recollection by Eric Fromm of his great-grandfather. And I'm quoting from Terry Eagleton's review of the book on the Frankfurt School by Rolf Wiggershaus. This is about Eric Fromm's grandfather. He sat there all day in the little shop where he made his living and studied the Talmud. When a customer came in, he looked up unwillingly and said, "Is there not another shop you could go to?" If one wanted an image of the Frankfurt School, one might well find it there. That image is one of indifference or aloofness from politics, often associated with Theodore Adorno. But here's another one from an interview with Angela Davis, who was a student of both Adorno and Herbert Marcuse. There is a story I like to tell about Marcuse's involvement in the University of California, San Diego. Back in the late 60s, the emergent black student organization, in alliance with the Chicano student organization, decided to campaign to create a new college at UCSD, the Lumumba Zapata College. At one point in a rather protracted campaign, we decided to occupy the registrar's office. I said I would ask Herbert about his possible participation in the takeover. I explained to him that we would have to break a window in order to gain entrance. In other words, we risked being charged with breaking and entering and trespassing. If he were the first person to enter the building, we were less likely to be arrested. Without a moment's hesitation, Herbert agreed. "Of course, I'll do it." There was no question in his mind. At that time, he was about 75 years old. He was the first person to walk into the registrar's office. These two quotations produce what Walter Benjamin would have called a dialectical image of the Frankfurt School. It is not hard to see which end of its political activist spectrum Peter Marcuse inherits. And this leads me to my first point. Peter made his own history, but not just as he pleased. In his life and work, two circumstances were determinant in the first and the last instance: the German experience of defeated socialism and victorious fascism, and the contradictions of American society, where he ended up because of these German experiences. When we are thinking of Peter's work, we are also in the company of a man whose illustrious father participated in the German Revolution of 1918, went to study with Martin Heidegger at Freiburg University in 1928, the year Peter was born here in Berlin, fled Germany in 1933, following the personal advice of the philosopher of being himself, and became in the 1960s the leading philosophical inspiration for the New Left. In Peter Marcuse, the link between critical theory and urban studies assumes both biographical and substantive form. It is hard to think of anybody who brings together the personal and the political more profoundly than Peter. Next point. Peter Marcuse's life lies at the heart of the world historical triangulation of radical thought, revolutionary politics, and metropolitan life in the 20th century. The historical context into which he was born clearly marked the birth of the Frankfurt School as well as revolutionary urban theory. This was the conjuncture of modernism. As Perry Anderson noted in a memorable debate with Marshall Berman, it consisted of an explosive fusion of aesthetics, technology, and politics, especially in Germany, Italy, and the early Soviet Union. If the Frankfurt School offered a mediation between critique and utopia by the imaginaries and technologies of revolutionary art, then it is surely to this art that properly modernist architecture and urban planning belonged. Radical thinking on space begins at this extraordinary moment of modernism by experimenting with the roles of architecture and urban planning in revolutionizing the totality of society. Next point. Whatever happened to the revolution of modernism? We may approach this question by way of a more famous one posed by Le Corbusier: architecture or revolution? He answered his own question in the last words of Towards an Architecture, published in 1923. Revolution can be avoided. But Corbusier's question arose when the subjective and objective conditions seemed ripe for a radical transformation of both space and society in the old world. Indeed, more than a handful of artists, architects, and planners then aligned their vocation with that of the revolution, as recounted, for example, in Anatole Kopp's great book, Town and Revolution. Their thinking was expressed not in a fetishism of spatial form, but in a utopian political slogan, architecture and revolution. As we know, however, the attempt to change both space and society miscarried, but not because modernism was infected by an occidental virus called reason. On the contrary, it is the triumph of military Keynesian capitalism after the Second World War that extinguished the revolutionary energies of modernism and ushered in modernization. The difference between modernism and modernization still matters very much for us, and it can be represented in this formula: modernization equals modernism minus revolution. I submit that what happened to revolutionary urbanism is best seen from a standpoint located in the future that was promised but never delivered by modernism. From that view, the line to be drawn in the sand of architecture and urban planning in the 20th century runs not between modernism and postmodernism. It runs between those who fought for architecture and revolution and those who said revolution could be avoided. It is the latter who defied the ideology of modernization, the episteme of development, and refied the reason of capital. The political economic nature of what appears here to be reason gone mad is in fact better theorized in classical Marxist terms as an outcome of the conceit of liberating humanity by the development of only the forces of production, while spreading on a global scale the actually existing relations of production. My next thesis is about postmodernism, and you can probably already anticipate what I'm going to say, so I'm going to skip it. Perhaps less said about it, the better. On Marxist urban theory, then. The fate of radical urban praxis after the revolution was derailed mirrors the fate suffered by Marxism under the same circumstances. Both registered a repression of practice that was sublimated in theory. Whereas Marx's own thought moved from philosophy to politics to economics, the trajectory of Western Marxism ran in the opposite direction, towards superstructures. Here, as Perry Anderson reminds us, it was culture that held the central focus of attention. And within the realm of culture itself, it was art that engaged the major intellectual energies and gifts of Western Marxism. The city, as such, did not figure centrally in its canon, although Benjamin, Lefebvre, and the Situationists stand as the exceptions that prove this rule. When Anglo-American Marxist urban studies came into its own in the 1970s, however, none of them played substantial roles in it. Benjamin was barely mentioned. Guy Debord was as good as a dead dog. Only Lefebvre popped up here as an intriguing but errant inspiration. It was a distinction of Marxist urban theory in its formative moment to bypass the entire output of Western Marxism and return to Marx's great work, Capital, itself. While critical urban theory helped in this way to bring Marxism back to economics by means of space, paralleling Mandel's late capitalism more than Marcuse's aesthetic dimension, it shared, however, with Western Marxism, a soft spot on politics. Urbanization relates more directly to capital than does political struggle or cultural production. In the city, determination in the last instance by the economy is more real than imagined. But while political economic approaches excel at explaining how the city came to be what it is less they are less adept at anticipating what a good city may be like and how we might go from the city we have to the city we love. The structural functional cast of Marxist urban political economy only highlights the absence of Western Marxists from it, especially Benjamin, who found in the everyday life of the city material evidence for humanity's unrealized dreams and theorized utopia as something to be actualized by means of an encounter between these dreams and the new technologies of modernism. Here he was responding on the one hand to the real challenges of building communism, having visited Moscow in the mid-1920s. On the other hand, Benjamin is following a famous letter written by Marx to Arnold Ruger in 1843. Our motto must be reform of consciousness, not by means of dogmas, but by analyzing the mystical consciousness unclear to itself, whether it appears religiously or politically. It will then become clear that the world has long possessed in the form of a dream something of which it only has to become conscious in order to possess it in reality. Let everyday life become a work of art. Let every technical means be employed for the transformation of everyday life. These are Lefebvre's words, uttered in unison with Benjamin's. Together with Thibaud, he defined Marxism above all as a critique of everyday life, and understood by means of this concept a level of social reality that is dialectically articulated with two other fundamental ones, the urban and the global. In Lefebvre's work taken as a whole, we therefore find a new conception of totality presented in terms of levels of the social, each of which possesses their own dynamic scales, and among which the urban level plays the most decisive mediating role. The radical implication of this contribution by Lefebvre to Marxism is spelled out in both Critique of Everyday Life and the Urban Revolution. There can be no socialist revolution without an urban revolution, no urban revolution without a socialist revolution, and neither without a revolution in everyday life. This is the backdrop against which Lefebvre's concept of the right to the city must be understood, not as the latest addition to a contradictory liberal democratic list of human rights, but as the right to a radically different world. Revolutionary urban theory equals politics of prescription. I unfortunately don't have the time to say what I mean by this, but let me read it anyway. Okay, Lefebvre's insights on the urban offer an invaluable starting point for urban political economy to broaden its intellectual horizons and sharpen its political vision. As demonstrated, for example, in Christine Ross's incisive engagement with the problematics of gender and colonization in Fast Cars, Clean Bodies, a study of French post-war modernization. The extension of urban theory in such directions assumes much urgency in the current imperial conjuncture to inquire into the possible roles assumed by cities in the new world system. Such theoretical labor, however, must not merely be descriptive. We cannot afford to abandon today the question of politics. But can our thought of politics be rescued from the grip of capital and state while being vigilant of their existence? Adorno said, I quote, "Economics is no joke, and merely to understand it, one has to think economically." The utopia of the Frankfurt School provides us with an antidote to the state-capital circuits imprinted in our minds. But we also need a new concept of politics liberated from a transitive relation to capital, as proposed, perhaps following Alain Badiou in Peter Hallward's manifesto, The Politics of Prescription. And finally, I want to say that last night, Peter Marcuse was right about two things. Well, more than two things, but at least two things, right? One, the task of theory today is to redefine what we mean by revolution, because socialism and fascism as we knew them from the last century are no longer options. And second, we need to, of course, ask whose right to the city are we talking about? And with respect to these questions raised in a utopian key, I can perhaps do no better than to conclude with Herbert Marcuse's own last sentence to the one-dimensional man, which is a direct quotation from Walter Benjamin. It is only for the sake of those without hope that hope is given to us. Thank you.
Great. So thanks to the three panelists for three stimulating presentations. If I could ask you guys to come up to the front, and I think the way we'll do, we have 30 minutes, give or take a few, and what I would propose is that we collect a bunch of questions and then turn it over to the panelists to respond to whichever ones. And that way we can get more people involved in the conversation. I think we're going to use that format for the 2 days. And if people could identify yourselves before you ask the question, that way we at least have some sense of who's asking the question. And I don't. We have microphones, but I don't know if we need them. Can people hear without a mic if you speak loud? You can't. No. Okay, it's better with a mic. So we've got to figure out a way to pass out these mics. Maybe I'll hand these up. Margaret, thank you. Okay, the floor is open.